the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Retirement. Everybody dreams about it, and you've probably been told, well, when it comes to retirement, it's all about a number. But things are changing. Stock markets rise, they fall, and sometimes they don't go up at all. Joining me on the program is Reshma Kapadia from Barron's, and she recently wrote an article called The New Retirement Strategy. Reshma, let's talk about retirement today. I mean, if anybody is looking at what the stock market just did over the last 10 years, you got to be optimistic. You're thinking, boy, double digits every single year, I could get to that number and retirement looks pretty good, but there may be some problems on the horizon. Let's talk about why that may be.
Sure. Well, I think that's one of the reasons we need to be a little cautious, because we have had very great, great returns in the market. Often after a period of great returns, they can't last forever. And, you know, I spoke to someone at Morningstar who sort of crunches these numbers, and he has a very sort of gloomy perspective of what returns are going to be in the future. If you average for like a 50-50 portfolio of stocks and bonds, he's looking at 0.5% annual compounded return, which is far from what we've been sort of accustomed to recently, especially with the market doing what it's been doing. That obviously means a lot of different things, and also means that many of the expectations that people have baked into their models, which have been historical return of sort of mid-single digits, might be too high.
You know, Reshma, the thing that really strikes me, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, you know, when you mentioned this study that maybe people can expect maybe 0.5% return going over the next decade, that may sound unrealistic, but I'd like to point out, if you were in a S&P 500 index fund, January of 2000, you saw the market drop 50% the next 2 years, then you went up for 5 years and you got back to where you were almost in March of 2000. But then you went down 58%. So it wasn't until, I believe, March or April of 2013 that you got back to break even again and you started making money. Now, I want to talk about something that there's implications here from your piece, because a lot of retirement plans are based on what we call withdrawal rates, anywhere from 3.5% to 7%, where people are drawing down their assets. Now, if you've been taking 5% or 6% as a drawdown from your portfolio the last 10 years and you were in stocks, you probably did okay. Let's talk about why that might not work if you're only getting 0.5% return in the market.
Right. I mean, it's just not, the math doesn't really work out. And I think that, you know, I've done other stories in the last year or so talking about how we need to sort of think about that retirement withdrawal rate differently, depending on sort of what is in your portfolio. If you have more guaranteed income, whether that's a pension or an annuity, which we can talk more about, that gives you the ability to perhaps have a higher withdrawal rate. But, you know, given where the market is now and these returns, you really want to be conservative. And that's what many people sort of suggest, to be at that lower end of the range you talked about. One of the other things in my reporting that people have mentioned is sort of this, and I think you talked about this too, just having a floor created by something called like a very simple income annuity. And annuities are, you know, raise all these sort of red flags for people. But for these simple sort of income payout annuities, the academics love them. It's really a protection against longevity. It also just gives you a floor to perhaps invest the rest of your portfolio in a more constructive manner. So that's one of the things people are talking about.
You know, it's interesting that we're talking about annuities, and it's something that we use in our practice, because simply today, you know, is if we're talking about somebody, they're 65 and they, you know, we give them a health questionnaire that we go through looking at longevity probabilities, family history, and if either husband or wife could spend 25, 30 years in retirement, that's a long period of time you're going to have to rely on assets. And if you want something predictable, the nice thing about annuities, if an insurance company gives you an annuity, you know you're not going to outlive it. And Reshma, let's talk about, you know, back in the 70s, I got in this business in the 80s when defined benefit pension plans were the pension plan of choice. A lot of individuals retiring back then. had a defined benefit pension plan. They got 60, maybe 70% of their salary in a defined benefit pension plan. Then you throw in Social Security. So they walked into retirement almost making what they did when they started work. And that worked pretty well. Let's talk about immediate annuities and how that may be kind of like creating your own defined benefit pension plan, because what you are doing is creating a income stream for the rest of your life.
Right. And I mean, I think what was so great about that period of the pensions was, you know, I did another story that perhaps pensions were not as rich as we all think about them. But what it did was at that point where someone goes into retirement, it converted that lump sum of money into an income stream for the rest of their life with that, with Social Security. So those were two things that were sort of guaranteed income for the rest of their life. So it dealt with the longevity aspect. You know, you didn't have to worry so much about what your portfolio was doing in terms of volatility. And that is one of the sort of missing pieces for today's retirees, many of whom do not have a pension. That sort of, you know, idea of when you go from accumulation to deaccumulation, what do? And that is sort of, that change is really where people think an income annuity can help out. Now, there are all kinds of, you know, sort of caveats, and you really want a low fee, very simple income annuity. The more sort of bells and whistles you put on it, the more it detracts from what it's supposed to do. But it kind of creates that stable stream of income. So with that and Social Security, if you can cover, you know, 2/3 or more of what your living expenses are, that gives you a lot more freedom and a lot more sort of peace of mind, really, to go on into retirement and do what you want to do.
You know, your piece has two implications for it. And for our listeners who are, let's say you're out there listening to this podcast and you're maybe in your 50s, there's two implications. One, the lower rate of returns means the number that you're trying to reach for a retirement, you're either going to have to save more or you're going to have to work longer. Because
yeah, two things no one wants to hear, but those are really, that's the truth.
Yeah, because if we're talking about lower rate of returns, the example we talked about, the stock market from 2000 to 2013 with two bear markets losing over 50%, you know, you do not want to be drawing down. One thing that we use in our practice that we found very helpful, especially for individuals that have to go through a drawdown, is to build up cash reserves that you can live off during the bear market period. If the bear markets on average last about 9 months to a year, last one was a little bit longer than that. But that way, if you have a cash reserve, it's kind of like a spare tire, you can live off that and not draw down assets, because it could be devastating to one's retirement if you have, let's say, a 4% withdrawal rate and you're selling off shares every single month to live on when the market's going down. That's dangerous.
It is, and it really sort of can torpedo your retirement savings. And so that is actually another thing that I've been hearing a lot about, is people building even the 2-year sort of cash kitty within their retirement portfolios to pull from, especially if they're in the RMD stages, enough to meet sort of 2 years of RMDs if they have got other expenses covered. And, you know, the good thing is the cash is actually returning more than it was a couple years ago. So it's maybe a little less painful to do that. And it also just gives you that protection.
Let me ask you, you write about financial markets, you write about retirement. What is it that annuities have gotten such a bad name? In fact, there's even one prominent money manager that said he'd rather go to hell than sell an annuity.
Yes. Well, I think that when people think annuities, they often think about sort of variable annuities, and they also think about the fees and the complexities, and these are products that are sold. And there is a lot of truth to that. There are sort of slivers of the annuity market, though, that are definitely worth consideration. And to be honest, these income annuities are not very popular. So the academics love them. Everyone will talk about how these are great things, but they're not bought very often. And one thing is that people want those to be put into 401k plans. And there is some legislation going through Congress where they're trying to get that put in and safe harbor sort of relax so that companies or plan sponsors will feel okay including this. If that happens, I think that will be very helpful, but we're not there yet. So I think it's just, and with good reason, it's been the fees and the complexities of these products, and no one likes the idea of giving over a chunk of money and perhaps not living long enough to see the results of it. And you know, you kind of have to think about it as insurance. It is insurance, but it gives you some sort of peace of mind. And I think that people maybe need to think about it differently for the very, you know, the low cost, simple annuities out there.
You know, two of the combinations, and, you know, we've talked to people like Wade Fow. He's an academic at right. American College, and they love it for what we call the flooring, the stability, the fact that you have a level of income that is not going to change no matter what Chairman Powell at the Fed's doing or what the stock market's doing. But they also like combining it, Rashma, with something like our favorite approach is dividend paying stocks. So you have something in your portfolio that is increasing your income. And I'd like to talk about that for a while, because sometimes clients get, and individuals, they see the stock market, for example, what happened in the last quarter of the year, or you take what happened to the market in February of last year after 4 weeks of record-setting pace in the stock market, we gave it all back in 6 days. And the nice thing about dividend paying stocks, and the example I always like to give, I don't care if you take a Coca-Cola, a Procter & Gamble, or even an Exxon. You know, during from 2007 to 2009, Coca-Cola lost a third of its market value. But here's the great thing about somebody that's using it for a retirement. During that whole period of time, you were getting a 7% dividend increase each year. So during the downturn, your income went up almost 25%. And when the market recovered in March of 2009, by the end of the year, it was back up to 30 again. So combining, let's say, an income annuity that creates a floor with some dividend-paying stocks is, you know, the academics love this type of strategy.
Yeah, and I think when people think about income, the thing to stress with dividends is you really want to look for the companies that can continue growing their dividends. And I mean, you mentioned several that have done that consistently. I think one of the dangers right now is people who search for yield and sort of sought out just the highest yielding stocks, and that's not necessarily the strategy you want to pursue. But the sort of dividend growth has been a strategy that many fund managers also really kind of pursue and have done well in tumultuous times because of that strategy.
You know, something that really hit me about that is, and you know him, Ralph Ancomporo, who's a legend in the technical industry. I was asking him, because the market, the last time I interviewed him, was a little bit on shaky ground, and Ralph is known for his prescient calls in the market. And I said, what do you tell people that are relying on, let's say, income to live in retirement? And he told a personal story, Rashma, that I think has a lot of credence here. And that is, he goes, his wife was a stockbroker, and she always recommended to her clients dividend-paying stocks, high-quality companies that increase their dividends. So Ralph was saying in 2008, he went to his wife, Rosemary, and he said, Rosemary, I think we need to get out. And she said, Ralph, we're in this for the long run. And he started to bring it up, well, the market's at risk of rolling over. And she said, yeah, you told me that in 2000. So the long and short of it is, they held on to their dividend-paying stocks. He said, we hold them when they go down. We hold them when they go up. But the nice thing about it is they go up with the income. And I think you're going to see, or I'd like to get your opinion, don't you think the kind of markets that we've seen, it's going to take a change in thinking by investors and advisors about retirement, what needs to be done to achieve a successful retirement? In other words, you don't go broke in the latter stages of your retirement years.
Exactly. I mean, I think just generally for investors, there's been a bit of a sea change now that we've sort of seen a pickup in volatility, and some of these less sexy, you know, dividend growth stories are probably going to get more attention. The quality companies that have had the strong balance sheets and the cash to sort of pay those dividends are also probably going to get a lot more attention as debt becomes sort of a four-letter word as we go through this cycle. And so you mentioned income and income-producing stocks, all of which I agree with. The one thing that I do want to mention is that, you know, delaying that Social Security beyond 65 may become even more attractive. And I know there's a lot of pushback against, you know, sort of delaying it. But, you know, when it kind of amounts to an 8% increase for those years that you're delaying it, and then a larger survivor's benefit, that kind of is even more attractive in a world where we're having lower returns.
No, and that is a very, very good point. I had a doctor who, his dream, he became a client in 1985, and when he turned 65, it came time to retirement. As we looked at his numbers, he, you know, he had a fairly good-sized portfolio, but he still didn't feel fully secure. Obviously, $1 million today doesn't buy you the same thing that $1 million did 10 years, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago when he became a client. So what he did and what we did in his plan is he chose to work part-time until age 70 and delay his Social Security benefits, because as we told him, I don't know any place I can guarantee you an 8% increase every single year, which is what you get if you delay it. The other thing he did is we call it the go-go years, the first phase of your retirement, age 65 to 75. We were talking about, you know, that's when he wanted to do a lot of his traveling. So by working part-time, he generated enough income to pay for a lot of those trips to go to, you know, Australia. He went to China. He went to Europe. Now he's in his 70s and what we call the go-slow years. But by, number one, delaying his retirement on Social Security, that's up 32%. So he gets a much larger check and consequently his wife. But more importantly, he allowed his pension and personal assets to accumulate another 5 years. And you add the bull market that we've just been through, his assets are significantly higher.
It's true. I mean, just there have been, I have done other recent stories that just talk about even working a year longer, how much that, you know, there's really very little in terms of savings that you can do to make up for that extra year of delaying your Social Security, you know, your assets compounding, you're adding to your income. I mean, it's just the power of it is quite great. I mean, obviously, it's not possible for everyone to continue working part-time or otherwise. But if that is an option, that is something that can have even more bang than any hot investment you can find your hands on, get your hands on.
Let me talk about another economic implication of that. If more and more baby boomers get to age 65 or let's say 66, which is full retirement age, and they decide, look, I just don't have the money to retire comfortably at 66. If I wait 4 more years, my Social Security will go up 32%. So I'm going to retire at age 70. I'm going to work 4 more years. What are the implications for the labor force?
Yeah, that's a major issue. So the advice is always to work longer, but the labor force has not necessarily gotten that message. And so there is a bit of a disconnect. But I think companies themselves are realizing that there is value in allowing employers, perhaps employees, downshift or take a different role, more flexible hours or something that's less demanding, but still be there to help act as a mentor and yet still offer up a spot for the middle level people who are moving up the ranks to get into those leadership roles and not leave their company and go somewhere else. So this is something that I think a lot of companies are focusing on, especially because unemployment is so low. You know, they're having trouble filling some jobs. And I think it's a conversation that we'll be having for years to come, because this is an issue. They both, that people need to work longer, want to work longer, and that employers need these people and their knowledge too.
Yeah, because you know, you get young people coming out of college. It's kind of nice to have somebody that's been with the company for a while, has the age and wisdom to help train, mentor younger people coming into the workforce. But you know, as we're talking about your article and the things that it implies, lower returns. So that has two implications. It means if you're retired, you may not be getting the returns you were expected in terms of, let's say, drawing down your assets. So if we do go through a bear market, which I think we're going to eventually have, we're about, what, 10 years into this bull market, it implies, number one, you should have a cushion that you can rely on. And as you mentioned, I think 2 years is a good level to feel comfortable to ride out any downturn so you don't have to pull down assets when they're declining. That's number one. Number two, the returns that you imply in your article means that if you're saving retirement, you're in your 40s, maybe your early 50s, you might have to, number one, work longer. Number two, save more to reach the goals that you plan for retirement. And number three, this idea that, well, as soon as I can get, well, you can get your benefits at age 62, which we don't recommend. But more and more people are going to have to think about Social Security delaying that to age 70. And Rushmore, what about the idea of, like, let's say working part-time, which is what we're using as one of the tools with a lot of our clients. We're just saying, look, try to do something. And in this, we have found many people have said, you know, there's something I always wanted to do that I didn't do during my working career. And they're living, one of our clients ended up being a tour guide at Hearst Castle, and he absolutely loves it.
I mean, and I think that that's this idea of working longer doesn't mean that you work longer at your, you know, 65-hour a week job, you know, working to your 110%. And I think that people need to just think about working in a different way. Also, we're living longer. So, you know, are we going to want to be quote unquote retired in the old sense of retirement for 30 plus years? I mean, it's a lot of people find great enjoyment in still being involved in some way, whether it's working part-time or otherwise. So I do think that there's that to think about. And it, like you said, especially, you know, I think I've done some work on couples and women especially. So if, you know, you're in a couple and your spouse is younger than you, it instead of that younger spouse retiring early to hang out with the older spouse, I mean, it behooves at least the younger spouse to keep working part-time to continue to sort of get some income, get Social Security credits, and not sort of claim early. So there are a lot of different things that people need to think about. And one of them, I think, is this part-time idea, just to kind of either keep working for insurance or keep working for enjoyment or a little bit of income or to delay Social Security, whatever the thing may be. I mean, we do have to say that it's not possible for everyone and that, you know, we also need to see a shift in the corporate arena to make this more feasible. But if it is an option, it does sound like a good thing to do.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point. In fact, we had a case a while back where there was a 14-year age difference between the husband and the wife. And 85, I think the figure is 85%, Reshma, of Social Security survivors are women. And for those listening on this show, when let's say the husband is the first to pass away. Well, what happens is the wife is going to lose one Social Security check. She has the choice of either keeping her own or her husband's, whichever larger. So let's assume the husband goes, she chooses her husband's Social Security. She's going to lose her own Social Security. So that's a big check that's going to go.
Yep.
And it's another reason the best thing a husband can do, especially when there's an age difference between him and his wife, is to delay that Social Security to age 70, which means his surviving wife and spouse will get a much larger check as she loses her own Social Security, making the choice to take his.
Yeah, no, I think that that's very good advice and something that we don't talk about as much, but we should talk about sort of, you know, differences in family structures and things like that.
Rushma, as we conclude, what would you, if there was one thing that you gathered from your research here, if there was one thing that you would tell our listeners as a result of it, what would you tell them?
I mean, I think that we need to rethink some of the conventional advice that's been out there, you know, sort of the 4% withdrawal rate, retiring at 65, you know, just ending your job at 65. I think that we really need to sort of dig a little deeper and rethink each one of these steps, and asset allocation, withdrawal rates, working, you know, other tools that you can have to sort of help create a little bit of a floor since the pension system is no longer doing it for most people. And just really not looking at retirement as a one-size-fits-all situation, which I know many advisors are good at sort of personalizing the advice, but when it's out there in the mainstream, it's often sort of given as this mythical couple who retires at the age of 65 and goes to the golf course or takes cruises. And obviously, we don't all live like that.
No, not at all. And just as the name of your article, The New Retirement Strategy, you know, it's not just those planning for retirement, but also advisors are going to have to think much, much different going forward because we're certainly operating in a much different environment. Rushma, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Great article, caught my attention because this is the way we think at our own shop. And I thought, wow, this, we ought to be talking about this more often because it is the new reality of retirement. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. It was great to have you back.
Thank you, Jim. This is great. Thank you for inviting me.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.